yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, the topic of today's show is capitalists raising the red flags. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, you know, whenever there is a crisis approaching, there are certain prescient representatives of the capitalist class who see it coming. They're very well informed, and they know how the system works, and they know how and when it is approaching trouble. Well, everybody knows we are drifting in that direction. Global trade, global economy. Well, we got a little boost here in China that pumped up its economy again here through fiscal, direct fiscal means, and that's sort of stabilized things a little bit, but not very much. You know, each time they try to pump the economy back up, whether it's in China or here, they get less and less bang for their buck. And that's what's happening. And we got a little reflection of that in the stock market, recovered a little bit. And, of course, the Federal Reserve and all the central banks are lowering their rates, and that's boosted financial markets as well, but not so much the real economy. Well, the figures came out yesterday that in the U.S., retailer consumption, retail sales has improved. Well, yes, after declining 2 months in a row. So if you look at the last 3 months, it's flat. It's flat. And usually you get a lot more spending here around tax day. But not so much this year. Oh, well, that's because there's not been very many or as much refunds as there usually have been. Well, we talked about that last week when we talked about the tax system and the big ripoff here. But we're talking about a bigger picture now. Returning to the capitalists themselves, I'm referring to recent public warnings raised by two of the most notable U.S. capitalists here, Ray Dalio, who is the head of the world's biggest hedge fund called Bridgewater Associates. He's worth about $18 billion. And in a series of LinkedIn essays, he's raising warnings. Even saying that some form of revolution is probably on the horizon if something is not done relatively soon about the income inequality trends running away, accelerating, not just in the U.S., but pretty much everywhere around the advanced economy world. We see the same phenomenon of escalating income inequality. And Dalio worries about this and has pretty much raised the red flag, you might say, in a two-part series published on LinkedIn. Go to linkedin.com/pulse/ why, how capitalism needs reforms, parts 1-2, Ray Dalio. Okay, take a look at that. And you see that Dalio is raising this warning, and he has been, you know, earlier this year as well in January, but now as well, once again. And, you know, at Davos, where the capitalist elite gather annually last January, February, also we had a fellow, I forget his name exactly, but he, you know, an academic there warned about it once again. a historian, a Dutch historian, I think his name is Bregman, right, who pretty much threw in their lap saying that you guys love to talk about inequality without admitting that the rich aren't paying their share of taxes as a root cause. And as Bregman said, quote, it feels like I'm at a firefighters conference and no one's allowed to speak about water, unquote. Okay, well, the other major capitalist here, I'm sure you all know his name, Jamie Dimon, head of the biggest bank in terms of assets in the U.S., Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, in a letter, 50-page letter to shareholders recently, he also warned, oh, he's a billionaire as well, he also warned about this growing income inequality. Well, they're talking about it, but they're not doing much about it. And they're trying to chastise their fellow capitalists to start paying more attention to it. Because ultimately, you know, it's this haves versus have-nots, which is fueling what they call populism, right? You know, the most immediate initial form of this has been right-wing populism. As the better organized and financed right wing can mobilize faster than the left wing, and they're doing so. And, you know, that's what Trump is really all about. But, you know, it's not just Trump. It's everywhere in Europe, especially Eastern Europe, you know, Poland and Hungary and even in Italy. You've got this rightward shift going on. And not just in Italy, we see it, of course, with the rapid rightward shift in South America, enabled and assisted significantly by the U.S., of course, to get rid of what was called the pink movement there in social democracy in South America, particularly Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, places like that. The U.S. Is fueling and funding and sweeping away, has been for several years now, all of the social democratic party and governments in South America. You know, this guy Bolton, neocon, who's running the foreign policy now of Trump everywhere. You can see his mark on it everywhere. From thwarting the agreement there with North Korea to building for an attack on Venezuela to now attacking Cuba and Nicaragua to moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. You know, this is all him. This is this guy Bolton. And he's pretty bold. Pretty bold about it because pretty much Trump is deferring to him. He found a real soulmate here, you know, in Bolton, and Bolton's dragging all the others with him, neocons back in, you know, the Millers, the Abrams, Elliot Abrams, all these guys that gave us Iraq and that fiasco, right? They're back there once again doing the whole thing. And you could see their influence in the and negotiations of trade with China as well. You know, Robert Lighthizer, he's of their ilk, Pompeo and so forth, in the State Department. They're all neocons, and they're running the show. But this is all part of this rightward drift. Philippines, even this guy Modi in India has elements of, you know, right-wing populism. I don't know why they call it populism, because it's not really popular in terms of the majority. It's a minority that's really forced its way and captured the institutions of these countries and imposing their policies. Well, but, you know, the income inequality is at the heart of all this, and it's driving it. Great resentments, people being left behind, you know, huge numbers of them. And it's not just the general working class being left behind. And they're all You know, when I say working class, I mean largely anyone who sells their skills on an hourly basis or a salary basis, even in some case, to make a living. To, you know, 90% of what you make is selling your skills to an employer. That's the working class. You know, those who don't sell and who you know, hustle and you know, engage in thievery of various kinds at the bottom, you know, that's not working class, that's subclass. And of course, those at the very top who make their living not by selling their labor, but by pretty much gaining the income that's produced by those who do sell their labor. You know, what's the cutoff here? It's hard to say exactly, the lines blur. But, you know, maybe in the U.S. here, you know, 200,000, you know, your high-tech skilled workers, engineers, and so forth are easily making, in California and other places, are easily making 150, even 200,000 without being in management. You know, if you're a data scientist, AI engineer, you know, you're easily making 200,000 here in California. That's the very peak. The top, you might say, of skilled labor. After that, you start getting into managerial roles and people who are in the service of those at the very top, and their whole role is control, to control the whole process on their behalf. Well, then you're leaving the working class, you know. So what we say is the middle class is really the working class. You know, if the middle class is median income in the U.S., maybe $60,000, dollars a year annual income. Well, you know, that's quote the middle, but it's really working class. They sell their labor like anybody else that does. Well, you know, it's elements of the working class that are most increasingly discontent. Maybe not all elements all at once. You know, if you're in high tech in California, you know, you're doing pretty good and you don't have too many complaints. But there's a lot of folks, maybe you worked in a steel or an auto plant in the Midwest, and you lost your job and you can't find another one except driving your car around doing Ubers. Well, you're going to be pretty discontent, right? And when it comes time to vote, you'll vote for the most vociferous critic of the system. And that's what happened in the U.S. That's what Trump did. While the Democrats were still saying how great it was and what a great you know, economy and country we have with all the free trade and taxes and so forth. So, you know, that's the U.S. Explanation, but you can see it in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. You can see it in Latin America and in places in Asia like Philippines and Malaysia and places like that. Okay, so it's a rightward drift that's going on. How do you stop this? Well, you got to deal with the underlying causes first and foremost, as well as politically organizing to contest this rightward drift with the right program and the right solutions. And you can see in the Democratic Party emerging voices that are trying to craft the right solution you know, address the concerns of those who are being left behind. And those in the middle class who are paying more and getting less for it. You know, that's happening on the fringe of the Democratic Party here. But you see at the same time the Democratic Party leadership doing everything they can to thwart it behind the scenes. You know, the attacks on Sanders, who's in that group, and then you have new voices in that group, Warren, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and some of the other Johnny Come Lately. Some of them are phony, trying to address you know, that growing trend You know, I think this guy Beto O'Rourke is a phony, being funded by a lot of rich Texas Republicans. And then this guy from Indiana, you know, I don't trust him either. He, again, is funded by a lot of rich folks who are rather conservative in Indiana. Some of the others I have no opinion on yet. They will become clearer, you know, the Kamala Harris's and so forth, the Bookers, you know, so forth, you know. So, you know, a lot of these candidates running in the Democratic Party here now for president nomination aren't really serious. They know they're not going to get the nomination, but they get a lot of publicity for their next campaign, you see. Plus, they get a lot of campaign contributions, which when they drop out, they get to keep for their next campaign. So it's a fundraising thing for some of these folks out there, you know, people coming from nowhere, throwing their hat in the ring. You know, they'll drop out, and it's really going to end up a contest, I think, between Sanders and whoever is the Democratic Party leadership candidate, and that's probably Biden, Joe Biden, waiting his turn. He's waiting for the rest of them to beat each other up. And, you know, we've got the Republicans and Trump here moving further to the right. The Republican Party is Trump's party now. He's pretty much captured it, and it's moved to the right. The Democrats' leadership are trying to see if a central in the political spectrum position is sufficient. I've been saying, no, their strategy of last midterms cannot work in a national election. But I'm not going to go there yet this time. All right, so let's get back to this inequality question that, you know, Dalio and Diamond are raising the red flag about. And, you know, pretty much saying this could get very serious if you don't do something about it. You know, Dalio talks about the demise of social democracy. In other words, Democratic Party in the U.S., our weak form of social democracy. You know, the problems with that, the collapse of the center and what's going on. He's correct in that regard. The social democratic parties, including Democratic parties, hitched their wagon to the neoliberal counter-revolution that began under Reagan. They thought that the way to opportunistically get themselves back in office was to become a Reagan light, a neoliberal light, you see. And the Democratic Leadership Conference of moneybag Democrats in the late 80s took over the Democratic Party. Their boy was Bill Clinton, and what we've seen is ever since, okay? Or all the way up to Hillary here and the collapse of that. They still control the Democratic Party, and they're doing all they can to keep it from shifting left and advocating those programs that people really want. I mean, you know, free college education, you know, one of them, you know, Green New Deal, guaranteed jobs, let's return the tax system back to where it was with 70% tax on the super wealthy, you know, multimillionaires, et cetera. You know, I mean, the program proposals aren't that bad from the left wing of the Democratic Party. But the you know, the money bags running the party will not allow that. And already they're upping their attack on Sanders. They're most worried about Sanders. The attacks have already begun on Sanders, and they will intensify. They will never let him get the nomination of the Democratic Party. Okay, so returning to the income inequality theme here. Right. It's important to understand there are three kinds of inequality. There's wage inequality, there's income inequality, and there's wealth inequality. All right. So let's talk about those because they're all related. They're all part of the same thing. And if you don't understand the differences, you can't really formulate a solution and proposals to reduce income inequality. You know, that's the symptom. Income inequality is the symptom of the crisis. It is not the problem per se. It is the consequence of a bigger picture and the problem. Okay, so what's wage inequality? Well, wage inequality, you know, economists talk about the wage structure, as they say. You know, people making a wage. You know, that's at least 80% of the total workforce of 165 million in this country. What's a wage is an interesting question. You know, how do we define wage? The top 90%, and there was the top 10 percentile, the 90th percentile, they say, of the wage structure. Again, wages being anything from minimum wage up to, you know, about this $200,000 that we mentioned. That's the wage structure. Now, at the very bottom, the bottom 10%, you know, that's the minimum wage. You know, we've got the minimum wage, and just right above the minimum wage, that's whose wages are influenced by changes in the minimum wage. You know, you're talking about 20, 30 million people already, right? So what's a wage? Well, right away you think, well, it's the hourly pay. Well, a lot of people don't get paid hourly anymore. They get paid a salary every week, 2 weeks. Well, not week, 2 weeks, every 2 weeks. Sometimes every month, a salary. You know, why this shift towards salaried? Well, that's because employers don't want to pay overtime pay. See, if you're on salary, we can work you overtime, and you don't get any overtime pay. Well, you know, a lot of the top wage folks in high tech, you know, get a salary. They don't get a wage, and they work like hell. They work evenings. They work weekends. So their hourly pay is really less than the $200,000 a year. But hourly pay is typically the way, or a salary equivalent of hourly pay, is a way of defining what's a wage. All right. So when you read and listen to newspaper reports by the government of how pay is rising. Pay is kind of like a neutral term that can mean many things. Pay, hourly wage is more specific. But then sometimes they say pay is rising, and what they really mean is weekly earnings, not hourly pay. Right? Weekly earnings. Well, what's weekly earnings? It's your hourly pay times the number of hours that you work in a week. So in robust economic times, your pay, defined as weekly earnings, may be going up, not because your wage is going up, but because you're working more hours, you see. So, you know, are we talking about weekly earnings or hourly wage when we talk about pay? Well, then there's still even more that never gets included in the wage numbers, either as an increase or a decrease. And that's what I call deferred wages and social wages. Those should be considered as well. Well, what's a deferred wage? It's your pension. It's a pension payment because, you know, while you were working, you were putting money into a pension. Your contribution sometimes matched by an employer. Weekly, W-E-A-K, weekly, and sometimes not, you know, in a 401k plan, for example, or in a defined benefit pension plan, real pensions, a contribution be made by you and by your employer. Only public employees have that now. So that's a wage, you see. That's a deferring of a wage-paying payment now that you will collect when you retire. That should be considered in terms of wage inequality. Wage inequality meaning those at the top of the wage structure getting good wages and increases, and those elsewhere, the bottom 90%, not getting wage increases. And, you know, there has been the top 10% wage structure has been doing pretty good, particularly if you're in tech or healthcare or something like that, or a profession, you've been doing pretty good. But those at the median level may be stagnant, and those at the bottom level, depending most on minimum wage, which hasn't changed much, not doing so well, right? Actually going backwards. And if you throw in deferred wages from pensions, which have been declining, well, that actually reduces the wage structure even more. Right? So, you know, when they say, oh, the average wage is rising, well, how do they define the wage? Well, they're certainly not including deferred wages, pensions. And they may be talking about weekly earnings and hours of work and overtime pay and so forth. Needs to be clarified, you know, so you need to get a clarification. What are the assumptions that go into the definition of a wage? But it's true at the top, we're getting significant increases at the very top. Well, usually when they report wage trends, they say the average wage. They may say average hourly wage, or they may just say average pay or average wage, which means hours of work. Well, the average is pulled up by the 10% at the top of the wage structure, who are getting more than 3%, 4%. They're getting more, which means the mass of people in the middle may not be getting anything, and those at the bottom may be going backwards. So this averaging, is an obfuscation, average wage, average pay. This is the way government and pundits obfuscate, cloud over the actual trend, you see. And it's never including pensions, which are declining. Pensions are being dropped everywhere, have been for recent decades now. Okay. When you say what's happening in wage inequality, you really need to throw in what's happened to deferred wages, as well as hours worked, as well as hourly pay. And, you know, is the wage include a salary? Well, if it's a salary, then those at the top of the wage structure, lower level managers and so forth, are doing pretty good as well, right? The salary, if that's the wage, is rising for those at the top, as well as the hourly wage. Well, you know, most of those at the top of the wage structure are getting salaries. They're not getting hourly pay. They don't punch a time clock or anything like that. Oh, but then there's the social wage. What's the social wage? Well, it's kind of like the deferred wage. It's Social Security. You know, all these families in the middle income, the middle class, you know, most of them are on Social Security. A lot of the poor are on Social Security, too. What's happening with Social Security? Is it keeping up with inflation? You know, that's another way of truly estimating the wage inequality. What's happening with inflation? The more inflation, the less real wage you have. Well, the government underestimates inflation. I'm not going to go into the techniques of that. But that reduces the real wage, however you define wage, that reduces it, or, you know, it makes it look bigger than it is right now. Underestimate inflation, you underestimate, you overestimate the wage trend, right? Just as by averaging, you overestimate the wage trend for the middle class as well. All right, so social wage, pensions, deferred wage, they're not calculated in these wage numbers, and they should be, because they're going down. And then there's the whole question of not calculating in the unemployed. Unemployed have no wage. Might be offset a little bit by a transfer payment called unemployment insurance, but they got no wage. Shouldn't they be calculated when we into the total wage bill for all wage earners? the more unemployed, there's nothing there. That should reduce the average. But they don't do that. And how about all the people who have dropped out of the labor force? We're talking about millions. Well, they're probably not getting a wage, or they're hustling somewhere on the side. Shouldn't they be included as well? That was about 5 million people who don't show up in the job numbers, the employment numbers, because they've just dropped out due to the labor force participation declining. And what about people in the underground economy, which is ballooning in recent years, probably at least 10, 12% of GDP, maybe more in the U.S.? We don't know how their wages are doing. So wage inequality is growing, is the bottom line, growing far more than they're even reporting. Now, why is it important to talk about wage? Because wage inequality contributes to income inequality, the thing that Ray Dalio and Jamie Dimon are so concerned about. Yes. In other words, what happens on the bottom end is important of the whole comparison between haves and have-nots, you know, the 1% and the bottom 90%. Right? In other words, income inequality is a function of rising income at the top and stagnating or declining income at the bottom, or the rest. And you can get more inequality with wage decline and no capital income increase. You can get more inequality with wages even rising if capital incomes rise even faster. And you can get the worst case where capital incomes rise and wage incomes stagnate or decline. But even rising wages can be accompanied by rising income inequality if the sources of capital and non-wage incomes, capital incomes we call them, are rising much faster. And that's really what's happening, you see. The top 10% in the wage structure are doing okay. Those in the middle are stagnating, and those toward the bottom, with no minimum wage change, are doing worse. They're actually going backward. And some of them between the $24,000 and $60,000 a year, you know, that 40 percentiles, they call it, those folks are probably slowly going back at the rate of maybe a percent or so a year. Those, as you go up in the wage structure, are stagnant or rising a little bit. And then the top 10%, they're rising, nicely. In recent years, at least. Okay, so the wage trends and wage structures are pretty important as far as income inequality goes. If the wage structure totally is rising, well, then that reduces income inequality to some extent. But it hasn't been, you see. It's only been rising for the top 10 percentile or so, and even less than that if you really define wages the way you should, including deferred wages, social wages, unemployed lost wages, discouraged missing dropout wages, underground economy wages. You know, if you really wanted to look at all wage earners, you would look at all that and then estimate whether it's rising or falling. Well, I'm just going to assume, because of these general trends, that the wages are rising even less or declining even more than getting reported. So the bottom, the wage contribution, is contributing net to the income inequality. But that's only half of the story, as I said. The real part of the story is income inequality and the acceleration of income inequality due to the explosion of capital incomes, in other words, non-wage incomes. Well, what are the capital incomes typically? Well, they're dividends of various kinds. They're capital gains from stock and bond appreciation and you know, selling and so forth, interest income, rent income, royalties, although royalties could be working class royalties as well, people selling their property, like in Fort Worth, Texas, to put a drilling in their backyard, a drill, oil drilling machine in their backyard, and speculation, meaning buying something to sell it once the price rises for a capital gain, they call that, in derivatives trading, currency trading, selling, flipping real property, and so forth. So these create all kinds of capital incomes, capital gains, and capital incomes. And the people who make their living from this are the capitalists, right? Capital incomes, they're the capitalists. Right? We call wage, they call wage income earned income. So I guess this is kind of unearned income. Interesting terminology there. But dividends and stock interest, rent, royalties, speculation in various kinds of market instruments and real property, right? This is all sources of capital incomes. Well, you know, just the dividend payouts and the stock buybacks driving up stock prices and stock capital gains alone last year, $1.4 trillion. And it's been $1 trillion every year since 2011, 2012. It's averaged $1 trillion every year. So, wow, we're looking at $8 trillion or more being given to shareholders of stocks and bonds by corporations. You see, the more corporate profits grow, the more they can pass through. Corporate profits are a conduit. And business income profits are a conduit. These are institutional conduits for funneling those profits to the shareholders. And the shareholders are, you know, largely other institutions and very, very wealthy people. You know, you get some retail stock ownership, you know, in 401ks, but that's minuscule compared to who's really reaping, you know, the gains from stocks and dividends and payouts and so forth, right? It's the 1%. It's the 1%, maybe 2%, 3%, whatever, 5%. But it's the very, very top. And, you know, $1 trillion plus a year and rising in payouts to these folks. Well, that's playing a much bigger role in income inequality trends than you know, the fact that the overtime pay or something is happening or not happening for the rest of the folks. That's where the inequality really is occurring. It's the escalation, the acceleration of incomes at the top end, not so much the depression of incomes in the bottom, although there is some of that wage compression going on there as well. Right? So, how is all this profit being made? Well, the big profits are being made in financial asset markets. Stock market speculation, you know, interest, rent, derivatives trading, foreign exchange trading, currency, property, buying and selling, right? Financial markets. This is financial markets. And that's one of the characteristics of 21st century capitalism is that the financial markets are becoming relatively a far more important source of profit and capital gains than markets for real goods and services. I mean, relative, it's rising, it's relative. Right? Now, the other source of capital incomes, besides these financial market speculation and payouts and buybacks and so forth, is executive compensation, right? Here the lines blur between, these CEOs are, you know, they're working for a company. They get a paycheck too, right? So part of their executive compensation is a wage, you see. But the vast majority is not. they don't make their income largely from getting a salary. Some get more salary than others, and some get no salary, and it's all stock options, right? Or it's deferred wages. In other words, if you're a CEO, senior manager, you're going to have several pension plans, several, right? That's going to reduce your monthly or weekly pay because most of it's being funneled into deferred wages that you will get when you retire big time. You get a big pension, several pensions. They don't have just one pension. They have three, four sometimes, right? So they don't have to pay taxes, you see, on their wages. They get a salary. They get big deferred wages. But most of it comes from selling the stock and awards and options that the stock that they're given by the company. And some only get the stock that's all they want. Well, why? Because, your payment on stock, the taxation on capital gains is only 20%, right? The taxation on wage, right, is 37%, even after the Trump Tax Act. So, sure, they want to get their pay, and they'll double their income by taking, quote, their pay in stock options. And that's what they do. And there's other forms of subsidized income that never get taxed, you see, if you're in senior management. Well, like what? Well, a lot of these CEOs, they get free loans, no interest loans from their company to buy their house or something, buy a second house or whatever, right? They get their expensive country club fees paid. I'm talking like $50,000 a year to belong to an exclusive country club. Well, the company pays for that. They get to fly around on company jets at no cost. And there's all kind of perks, as they call them, you see, perks. And that's income, too, big time income. So executive compensation has been accelerating along with other forms of capital gains, particularly among American CEOs whose compensation is like double that of European and like quadruple that of Japanese CEOs in the same line of business, the same kind of company. So executive compensation is driving up income inequality, just as capital gains income, much bigger, has been driving up income inequality. Now, a third major way in which income inequality has been occurring is through the tax system and the redistribution of taxes. In other words, tax reduction for capital incomes while wage-earned incomes taxation is rising. And we can see this no better than in Trump's recent tax act. But Trump's tax act here, beginning of 2018, is really just neoliberal tax policy on steroids. This has been going on ever since Ronald Reagan, you see, and it's ebbed and it's flowed. But among all of the presidential and political party regimes since 1980, this has been a general long-term trend. More and more tax cuts. The corporate income tax used to provide 20% of government revenues. I think it provides like 4 or 5% now, right? Estate taxes, inheritance taxes used to be a big chunk. But now, if you're very wealthy, the first $22 million gets exempted from your estate. And it's like 0.25% of all the 130 million taxpaying households in the U.S. pay anything now in terms of the estate tax. And the numbers used to be very significant in terms of tax revenue for the government. But that, like the corporate tax, is just about disappearing now. And the reliance is all almost totally on personal income tax and the payroll tax. Okay, so the tax redistribution scheme favoring capital incomes means that they get to keep more of these escalating capital gains profits, you see. They get to keep more. They get more capital incomes through payouts and stock buybacks and interest and so forth. They get more, trillion plus a year, and they get to keep more of that trillion plus a year. Well, we've seen this with Trump, right? Personal income brackets, right, and thresholds have been changed to the benefit of the wealthy. The AMT, alternative minimum tax, has been really liberalized for the wealthy and eliminated for corporations. This new 20% pass-through is for non-corporate business. So, you know, they've been cutting corporate taxes so much, the small business has been complaining, where's our cut, right? So they've given this pass-through, a 20% pass-through. What is that? That's, you know, you can deduct 20% of your profits off the top before you calculate your taxes. Now, if you're a business, a non-corporate business, right? Now, what is it? You think it's all sole proprietors, mom and pop? No, no. It's partnerships. You know, it's energy partnerships. It's lawyer partnerships. It's real estate partnerships, right? They're the big beneficiaries of this. And by the way, Donald Trump, most of his business is susceptible or benefits from the pass-through. He's got all his little businesses. Actually, you know, they're mini LLCs, as they call them. And, you know, they're benefiting from this pass-through. So he's given himself a big 20% off the top here. So inheritance taxes, estate taxes, AMT, and so forth have all been reduced here. Effectively, the tax rate is not 37% here, you know, which reduced from 39.7 to 37% officially. But, you know, with all of these other tax cuts and loopholes, it's really about 26%. So they got like a big 13% net reduction in the personal income tax in various ways, just as the corporate tax went from 35 to 21 percent before all the additional loopholes are applied. You know, and if you're in the oil and gas business, or you've invested in sports teams, or you're a rich cattle rancher, or you say you are, you know, you buy a big ranch in Montana and you put a couple head of cattle on it, you let them run around, you're not really in the cattle business, but you know, you say you are, you get big write-offs for this, okay? So the tax system is playing a big role in income inequality. Executive compensation playing a big role. But financial asset markets and historic capital gains from financial asset speculation is playing a huge role in the whole process here. That's driving income inequality. Now, what about wealth inequality? What is that? Well, wealth inequality is simply your assets minus your liabilities. Or we call that your net worth. Well, that's been growing and growing as well. Well, why? Well, because rising income inequality creates opportunities for more investment in assets, and assets spin off more income. So there's a direct relationship, causal relationship between income inequality and wealth inequality. Right? More income inequality means you can buy more assets. Buying more assets means you have sources of throwing off more income. So it's a circular, mutually causing relationship between income and wealth inequality. So we see these three kinds of inequality, you know, wage inequality holding down pretty much the bottom of the whole process, and then income inequality rising at the top, generating more wealth inequality that generates more income inequality. Right. Now, what is Dalio talking about here to solve this, you know, or Jamie Dimon? You know, they talk about it, but, you know, they don't say much of what to do about it. And when they do, they're not saying the right thing. You know, Dalio says, well, you know, I'm contributing $100 million to schools and microfinance education in Connecticut, where I live, right? But does more schooling result in less income inequality? Has it, right? Well, we've been spending a lot on schooling, right? We spend a lot on higher education. We're spending more than ever before on K through 12 education, right? Has that been reducing inequality? No, because that's not the problem, you see. More schooling will raise wage, will address the problem of wage inequality. In other words, more middle class might be able to move to the top of the wage structure, might be able to, because more schooling really means STEM, right? More science, more engineering, more technology kind of education training. And the school system's not set up for that, really. So throwing more money into K through 12, I'm not arguing against that. Don't get me wrong, because it's really abysmal in some places, the quality of education, particularly in poor neighborhoods. But if you look at the amount we've been spending, has it been reducing income inequality? No, because the problem is not so much education, although it contributes a little bit. The problem is runaway capital incomes. And the problem is the tax system that allows the rich to keep more and more, and executive compensation. It's speculative incomes, financial incomes, and you know, the CEOs, the top 1/10, 1/100, or 1%. That's the problem, inequality. And Dalio is not addressing that, nor is Diamond. Has intergeneration income mobility increased? No. Will more schooling generate less intergeneration income mobility? No. Because labor markets are being restructured to reduce income. Yes, more part-time temp jobs, more Uber jobs, more gig jobs, and wait till artificial intelligence hits, and there'll be even less of those, you know, in the next decade, right? And to the extent that we're paying more for education, what are these education higher education institutions doing, right? Well, they're just raising their tuitions. You know, they're grabbing the student loans, raising the tuitions, adding more administrators, right? Or turning colleges into kind of youth resorts. You know, they all got to have Olympic swimming pools, and they all got to have big student unions and this and that and so forth, you know, as they compete, right, for the student debt dollars, you see. So more education is not going to solve the income inequality problem. That doesn't mean, you know, you should be against more spending on education. No. So how are you going to reduce income inequality? Well, you have to address capital incomes, and you have to address wealth inequality first and foremost while you're trying to raise earned income wages. But the big problem's at the top. Right, you have to redistribute the wealth. I say redistribute because we've already redistributed it, right, back to the middle class somehow, right? What are the ways of doing it? Well, the tax system is one of the big ways, right? You got to somehow stop this $1 trillion a year plus stock buybacks and dividend payouts. You know, that's got to stop. And that can be done through the tax system. And reverse this neoliberal tax shifting that's been going on ever since 1980. You know, multinational corporations, estate taxes, pass-throughs, AMTs, and all that reversal that's been going on, right? Stop the buybacks and payouts over $1 trillion, right? Reverse the tax shifting. Do something about executive compensation and actively redistribute wealth back to the middle class. At the same time, we can do something about the growing inequality in the wage structure, with the top 10% getting all the gains, right? You need to raise the minimum wage. You need to increase overtime pay. So you do something about weekly earnings. You got to do something about the deferred wage and the social wage solutions because they're going south. Reduce interest, right? Charges on credit cards and on student loans and general interest charges. We used to do that in the 70s. You know, there was a ceiling of 7% on interest on credit cards. That was nicely eliminated by Ronald Reagan. Do something about attracting people who have been dropping out of the labor force, bring them back. Equal pay for equal work. Do something to restore the union's role in maintaining wage growth here. Social programs, you know, Medicare for all will significantly increase the wage incomes of the middle class because the cost to the middle class of raising the Medicare tax, the payroll tax on Medicare, will be far less than the savings that they're going to make of not having to pay for private health insurance. You know, if you're buying Cadillac health insurance, you're paying 20, 25% of your income is going for that. Reducing your take-home pay, your disposable income, significantly. The Medicare for All financing costs will be far less, one-fourth or less of the cost that you're paying now for private health insurance. I think once people see this cost comparison, of course, the Democrats don't want to show that, and certainly the corporate media doesn't want to show that. You know, people will see, well, Medicare for All is a pretty good deal. I can get a big actual take-home pay boost by going Medicare for All and getting probably just as good or better health care. Okay. So, you know, Ray Dalio and Jamie Dimon should be looking at themselves and not making contributions simply for education. But how are we going to redistribute all this accumulated wealth at the top? How are we going to stop the feeding of the wealth inequality through the growing income inequality, which has to do with largely the tax system and subsidies to corporations and the buybacks and dividends, the conduit, main conduit by which this is occurring? And then doing something at the bottom, the wage structure as well, to raise the median and the low higher, at least have it grow, if not as fast as the top 10% tech wages, you know, more than it is right now. How do we do that, right? That would be a policy for reducing inequality. But you're not going to see that. You're not going to see that. Ray Dalio is worried, you know, that the next, he even talks about this, the next crisis, which is coming, he believes, what's going to happen then, right? With wage incomes so fragile, right? When you have mass layoffs again, what's that going to mean? And not just because you got fragile incomes, but because there's so much debt that's accumulated. The debt's not going to go away in the next crisis, but the income to pay for it will disappear. What happens then? Well, what happens then are defaults, bankruptcies, layoffs, which then reverberates onto business and their revenues and their profits. And then we got business defaults. And when we have business investor defaults, which is going to be exacerbated because they have excess debt as well, we're going to then get banking crashes. Okay, that's what Dalio's worried about. And Ray, there's my solution. Get serious.